Family Ties is a true crime podcast that focuses on the cases of children that have been killed or affected by the ravages of abuse, neglect, torture, assault, starvation, or any other crimes committed against children. Every day in the U.S., between 4 to 7 children die at the hands of parents, foster parents, or caretakers. That's an average of 2,000 children per year that die of totally preventable causes. We want to bring awareness to these crimes and uncover the effects and long-term damage that's a result of this national epidemic. We also discuss the ways we as a country need to change the broken system that is currently in place to protect children. The Family Ties is here to give voice to the voiceless and to challenge you all to take action in your own communities to demand better protection for our most vulnerable. Listener and viewer discretion is advised due to the explicit nature of the topics that we cover. Welcome back to the Family Ties podcast. Hi, you all. Kelly Ritchie here. Thank you for joining me today. I am wearing this fuzzy jacket because it decided to dump snow on us last night here in Colorado. It hasn't snowed but once this whole entire winter, but it's freezing in my room. And after this, I will be lighting a fire in the fireplace. So anyways, I'm just staying as cozy as possible. Before we get started though, I would like to invite each and every one of you to subscribe to my YouTube channel, like my videos, and share your thoughts and comments with me. And for those of you listening to the podcast, please rate and subscribe wherever you find your pods. I welcome your feedback as well as your suggestions and case recommendations. So please post away. Today we will discuss the disappearance and murder of 11-month-old baby Mercedes Lane, who was reported missing by her father Kenneth Lane and her mother Tiffany Coburn in August of 2021. Mercedes' dead body was found in the depths of the woods in Stark County, Indiana. This case has lots of twists and turns, with more than one victim. We'll get to all that a little bit later. And more than just one person that can be held responsible for the death of this precious baby. So without any further ado, let's dig in. According to the South Bend Tribune, the baby's parents gave Mercedes to Kenneth Lane's cousin, Justin Miller, to babysit so that the parents could have a break. On August 12th, Mercedes was with Miller at a motel on the northern edge of Plymouth, police said. The infant's father, Kenneth Lane, contacted Plymouth police on the afternoon of August 15th to file a missing persons report for his daughter. A silver alert was issued that night and the search for Mercedes began. Now, an amber alert was not issued because the parents did not believe Mercedes to be in any danger, nor had she been kidnapped. They knew she was with Justin Miller, therefore the criteria were not met to put out an amber alert. The South Bend Tribune reports that the police arrested Miller in the early morning of August 16th in Stark County. Later that day, police also arrested Mercedes' parents, Kenneth Lane and Tiffany Coburn. Miller initially told police that he took Mercedes while he stayed with a friend in Stark County and that he also visited his girlfriend in Mishawaka, but was kicked out and dropped the baby off with a woman at the motel back in Plymouth. Now, if this is true, I just want to point out how messed up it is that this poor baby is getting passed around from person to person, and even person to stranger, it would seem. Who is this woman he would have left the baby with at the motel? This is just tragic to me. It doesn't appear that Mercedes had parents who were fit to be parenting, for reasons we will discuss further in a bit. But one of the hundreds of red flags throughout this whole thing is that I can say one in particular that would indicate that they're unfit parents would be, I mean, just look at who they trusted their daughter with. I don't care if this guy is family. Although by taking a quick glance at the parents, it's clear they aren't society's finest either. I'm sorry, but Justin is just not a man any conscientious parent would choose as a caretaker for their infant. Maybe I'm really off base on that. Think I'm being harsh or unfair here? Well, I'm not the only one who believes Lane and Coburn to be unfit parents. CrimeOnline.com reports that Tiffany Coburn's own mother stated that they are definitely not good parents and that they didn't need to have a child. She goes on to say that we tried everything in our power to get this baby taken away from them. Owens, the grandmother, continues, we have called Child Protective Services many times. There's nothing more that we could have done than what we did. We have gone beyond our power in doing what we could do to help this baby. So it looks like even the grandma knew the baby was in danger with Lane and Coburn and was actively trying to save the life of her grandchild, only to have the system fail not just them, but just another child. My heart goes out to her and how helpless she must have felt. How tragic to know that your grandchild is in danger but not getting any help from the people who have the power to intervene. Next up, Miller's friend in Stark County said that Miller had come on August 13th with the baby and then left before returning on August 15th without Mercedes. On August 18th, Miller finally told police that he woke up to find Mercedes dead in a house in Mishawaka at some point on August 14th. He then led investigators to the area in Stark County near the intersection of County Road 1025 East and 50 North, where he disposed of the infant's body. An autopsy ruled Mercedes' death to be a homicide and the manner of death to be blunt force trauma to the head. Interestingly enough, both Kenneth and Tiffany were difficult to get a hold of while the search for baby Mercedes was underway. WTHR.com reports that during the search for Mercedes, police were also searching for her parents. According to court documents, before calling police about their missing baby, the two dropped off a duffel bag at a neighbor's. The duffel bag contained a safe, and court documents said that it was believed the safe contained illegal narcotics. When they're saying during the search for Mercedes, they're basically saying that before even calling the police to report Mercedes missing, they dropped off that duffel bag with the narcotics. So either these two are straight up addicts or they're dealers and felt the need to hide the narcotics in case their home was searched. This also indicates to me that they knew something had happened, or else why try to get rid of drug paraphernalia or act in this shady manner? When officers tried to follow up with Lane and Coburn about the timeline of events involving Mercedes, they said they were unable to make contact until August 16th at 8:30 a.m. Police said that Coburn had told them she was coming in to talk to them and was waiting on a ride from her sister. Police said that Coburn never showed up. And when they talked to her sister, she told them she had not seen Coburn since 3 a.m. when she had dropped them off from looking for the baby. In court documents, both Coburn and Lane were noted as being uncooperative in looking for their child. Coburn was ultimately found outside of the Economy Inn the afternoon of August 16th, while Lane was located at the Red Rock Inn in Plymouth around 6 p.m. on the 16th. During Coburn's questioning with police, she allegedly admitted she had been in contact with Lane and Miller multiple times during the time frame Mercedes was missing using Facebook Messenger. The court documents said that Coburn also admitted to using methamphetamine on numerous occasions. Court documents also say that Lane was told him he was also communicating with Coburn and Miller using Facebook Messenger. While he allegedly had been in contact with Miller, he did not know Miller's whereabouts, or so he claims. This is purely conjecture, but I wonder if Kenneth and Tiffany found out from Justin what had happened, which may have caused them to panic and become purposefully unhelpful to law enforcement. The timeline around the 15th and the 16th and their behavior change indicates that they knew something, as well as trying to dump all of the drugs at their neighbor's house. Also, I believe there's a lot more to this story than what's on the surface. As the case unfolds further and trials start up later this year, I'm interested to possibly find out what the message is going back and forth between the three were during that time. But essentially, poor baby Mercedes seems to have been stuck in the middle of a terrible situation where both parents and babysitter put their drug habits and criminal behavior ahead of the safety and care of their precious infant. There are some initial decisions being made as to where to try Miller because there are at least three counties where the chain of events took place. Pinpointing the location of the actual murder will most likely decide which county conducts the trial. Now, let me just also let you know that all this information kind of is dated from August and September, so I'm sure that they probably have pinpointed where they're going to do this trial, but I'm not finding it anywhere just because news updates are not really fresh on this. They're just dated to September. So I'm going to continue to look into this and try and dig further, and I'll let you guys know what I find. But as far as like when this occurred, this is what we know. The South Bend Tribune writes that Mercedes was first reported missing from Marshall County, so that's county number one, was taken to and possibly died in St. Joseph County, county number 2, and then buried in Stark County, county number 3. So according to Indiana law, a murder case may be tried in the county in which the cause of death is inflicted, death occurs, or the victim's body is found. Stark County Prosecutor Leslie Baker has requested a special prosecutor for the case, and she'd like it to be Marshall County Prosecutor Nelson Chipman. Baker's apparently been involved with one or more of the defendants involved here on a separate occasion for different charges. So Baker wishes to avoid a conflict of interest and is requesting a special prosecutor be assigned here. The elected prosecuting attorney believes that an appearance of impropriety may exist in this manner due to previous representation of material witnesses and the probable necessity of granting immunity to previously represented clients who have pending matters related to this case. I don't know exactly what the breakdown of that looks like, but Baker seems to think and feel strongly enough that she does not want this case to fail because, you know, she has a conflict of interest. But she wrote in a motion that basically the court documents like don't elaborate on what involvement she had with the other witnesses. So we'll see. But her motion asks for Chipman to be the special prosecutor for the case. Miller was first charged with child neglect resulting in death in Marshall County. So that was, I think, county number 2 that we discussed. Though Chipman has said he will likely dismiss that charge to avoid the double jeopardy provision of the U.S. Constitution now that Miller is charged with murder in Stark County. So double jeopardy in the legal definition is found within the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, basically just means that an individual may not be prosecuted twice for essentially the same crime. The minimum penalty for murder under Indiana state law is 45 years in prison, though Stark County prosecutors will seek to sentence Miller as a habitual offender due to 2 prior convictions for possession of methamphetamine, which would increase the length of the sentence imposed. Miller has also been working on his own plea deal, of which Mercedes' grandma Owens is also fighting to have the courts reject. She says, "I mean, an innocent child, my innocent grandchild. How could you just do that and expect, okay, you do 45 years and get out and you're fine? Where's my baby at? Where's her time at? Where's her life?" So both Lane and Coburn in August had requested to leave, or they requested leave to attend the funeral service for Mercedes. They were both allowed to attend under the supervision of the Marshall County Sheriff's Department on August 25th of 2021. Now I kind of want to get into a little bit more of why I feel so strongly about them being terrible parents. So Mercedes' father, Kenneth Lane, was charged with neglect back in 2016 after allowing a 20-year-old man to sexually abuse his 12-year-old daughter over an extended period of time, and in their own house, no less. The South Bend Tribune uncovered the story and reports that Lane's 12-year-old daughter, Paige, later gave birth to a child fathered by the man who her father had allowed to abuse her. The Tribune goes on to state that Lane and his then-wife, Mary Lane, knew the man was dating and having sex with their daughter, and even allowed him to live at their home for about 2 months, according to a Knox police report. What's even more disturbing is that Lane's daughter told police her parents were well aware De La Paz was at least 18. They hugged and kissed in front of her parents, and that both parents discussed their relationship with her. The daughter told police Kenneth Lane told her that age should not matter. Mary Lane told police her husband admitted to her that De La Paz sometimes gave him marijuana in exchange for allowing the daughter to spend time with De La Paz. They basically pimped out their underage daughter in exchange for drugs. I dare you to disagree with me when I say that Lane, Kenneth Lane, is a human piece of garbage, plain and simple. After being removed from the home and giving birth to a child fathered by De La Paz, the girl Paige and her son were eventually adopted by a staffer she met at a youth home, according to a report by radio station WKVI. In November of 2019, she appeared in a Stark County courtroom marking National Adoption Day to praise her adoptive family, saying she was as happy as could be, WKVI reported. Paige went on to give an interview to ABC 57 News in 2021 about life with Lane after all the news came out about Mercedes. So I'm going to read some of Paige's harrowing story in her own words, but be prepared for graphic and disturbing content here. Before Paige was even a teenager, she says she was forced to drink alcohol as young as 8. She says it was any alcohol her parents could find. She was also forced to take drugs. They got a kick out of watching us be, you know, messed up, Paige says, of her parents and their other partners. Hodge says she was forced into sexual encounters with an adult multiple times and even subjected to violence. I've been punched in the face by Kenny Lane, Hodges adds. All this happened by the time Hodges was just 12 years old in the home she lived in with her biological parents. I just remember not ever thinking anything was going to be normal, she said. It was just 7 years ago that Paige was living with her parents, Kenny and Mary Lane. She describes a nightmare that left her pregnant and in a foster home at the age of 13. Adults aren't supposed to kiss you. They aren't supposed to touch you. They aren't supposed to do any of that, Paige says. On Christmas Eve in 2014, Knox police opened an investigation into what was going on inside the Lane house. I found out that I was pregnant in November, Hodges says. November of 2014. According to the Knox police report, DNA samples were taken and police determined that 20-year-old Angel De La Paz was the father. De La Paz was the cousin of one of Mary Lane's co-workers. Both parents seem to be just crushing it with the friends that they have and the connections that they make. Back in October of 2014, an arrangement was made between the Lanes and De La Paz. In exchange for letting him live there and continue the relationship with me, he had set bills that he had to pay and set things that he had to give Kenny and Mary, which were drugs, Hodge explains. The Knox investigation confirms this, both an admission from Mary Lane and from Cody Byrne, Mary's then boyfriend, who also lived with the family at the time. I just caught this, but so it seems like Mary and Kenneth were married, but they had different partners at the time coming in and out of the house. That's also a really healthy environment for children. I had voiced what had happened to both Mary, Kenny, and Cody. So all three of them, Hodge says. Mary's exact response was, "You're going to continue to do it." Unbelievable. De La Paz was even allowed by the Lanes to sleep in Hodge's bed with her. The report says Kenny was questioned about Paige's pregnancy from a Stark County jail cell where he was being held in February of 2015 on a community corrections violation. At the time, he told investigators, while he knew Paige was pregnant, he didn't know De La Paz, adding his daughter wasn't with any adults. But Paige tells a different story, saying her parents even wanted her to get an abortion after it was discovered that she was pregnant. "I didn't want to do that," Hodge says. "I didn't know what that was. I didn't know what that would be. I already didn't understand being pregnant." Eventually, Paige had the baby, a boy named Oakley, but they were separated when he was born. Kenny and Mary were later convicted of neglect in the De La Paz situation. Now, I'm just going to say, this seems like a very light thing to convict them of, seeing as they pretty much pimped her out in exchange for drugs. I'm just going to say this seems very light. Kenny was only sentenced to 2 years behind bars while Mary got 18 months probation. This is just ridiculous. This is just telling people that they can do whatever they want, and there are really barely any consequences, if any. De La Paz was given an 8-year punishment, including 2 years of which was behind bars in prison. Also kind of light, Paige was adopted by a new family when she was 16, and eventually she got her son back. I'm really curious about more about this story, but I'm just glad that, you know, Paige's life is going in a different direction, and I think that it's a positive one. Paige, now looking back, says she believes that the Indiana Department of Child Services failed her and her two sisters. So there were other children in the home as well. She says DCS should have removed them all from the home much sooner. I agree, Paige. I agree. So this is just another case that they failed three other children. So let's just keep that in mind. She says multiple CPS cases were opened and then they just didn't get closed, she recalls. My little sister got a vacuum thrown at her. It hit her in the face. She had to go to the hospital and get it glued shut and everything. But when CPS got involved, they said they couldn't do anything because it didn't leave bruises. Paige remembers her parents lying to DCS to cover up the abuse and protect each other. After the nightmare ended for Paige, which I think that's a little hopeful for this article to say that, you know, this nightmare has ended for her, because no, like, she's going to be dealing with this the rest of her life in some way, shape, or form. And part of it is that unwanted pregnancy that she had no control over. And so, you know, whether or not she loves Oakley, which I'm sure she does, this, none of it was her choice. None of it was something that she had agreed to. And she was a minor. So this is just ridiculous. So her nightmare is not ended, but I appreciate their optimism. But Paige refused to contact Kenny Lane for years, but she says she always worried his other kids might be suffering the same situation. Then her half-sister Mercedes went missing. It began with a silver alert, and the moment that Paige saw it, she called Tiffany Coburn, Mercedes' mother. This was Sunday, August 15th, Paige recalls. I called at 11:36 p.m. Paige said that Kenny Lane answered, and she hung up, not wanting to talk to him. But then he called back. It seems like there's no way to avoid talking to Kenny if I want to figure out what happened, Hodges says. On the second phone call, Paige says Kenny told her Justin Miller, who Paige knew growing up, and said of Miller, she was surprised he would be involved in Mercedes' death, took Mercedes to babysit her on Thursday, August 12th. But Mercedes was supposed to be back for a birthday party the following day. She wasn't supposed to be gone any longer than that, Hodge says. The Marshall County Prosecutor's Office tells a story. Investigators believe Mercedes went with Miller on Friday because Kenny and Tiffany so that they could have a break. Kenny also told Paige that he and Tiffany tried to find Miller and Mercedes when they didn't return as scheduled. But when Paige asked more questions, Kenny changed the subject and asked her how she was doing. It seems to me like he didn't care, Paige says. She hung up on Kenny, not wanting to talk to him. Paige, you're a smart, smart woman. Police and investigators say it was difficult to reach and locate Kenny and Tiffany while 11-month-old Mercedes was missing, as we discussed previously. The morning of August 19th, at a news conference at the Marshall County's Sheriff Department, Marshall County Prosecutor Nelson Shipman said, "It took some effort to find them, Kenny and Tiffany." Paige was quickly able to get a hold of them twice. Regardless of the police's difficulty to reach them. So despite talking to Kenny while Mercedes was missing, Paige says she was never contacted by police or the FBI, who were also involved in the search for Mercedes. About Mercedes' death, she says, "I'm so mad right now, and it's probably why I haven't been able to cry." Court documents show Justin Miller claims he woke up sometime on Saturday. We've already discussed all of this. Paige says this wouldn't have ever happened if they didn't leave their child in the care of somebody who went out of their way to hurt this child. Her anger isn't just with Kenny and Tiffany. DCS should be held to the same account. I agree. Especially since not just the grandma, but it seems like more than one person was involved in contacting Child Protective Services to get them involved. Paige with Mercedes, maybe with her other two siblings. So CPS had multiple opportunities. And I'm so sorry, but if CPS can look with their own eyes at both these parents and think these kids are just lying and they're just making all this stuff up, I would like to kind of have them examined, because you look at them and you know that there is something off. And I'm not trying to be rude, but there is probable cause for some investigation here. And shame on them. Shame on them for failing four kids in this one situation. So as court proceedings against Lane, Coburn, and Miller, you know, began, Paige hopefully will get some answers. She said, "I see Mercedes and my son. We all look alike." The article says they reached out to Child Protective Services for more information on the Lane family case and specific case statistics on the number of cases across the state. Of course, DCS says it can't comment on the Lane family due to confidentiality regulations in Indiana child fatality statutes. But the person writing this article also gave the agency the chance to respond to Paige's claims, which others in Marshall County have expressed as well, that DCS fails children and leaves them in dangerous situations. Of course, CPS didn't have anything to say to that. What a shocker. So Paige and her sisters all experienced abuse at the hands of their parents, this article continues. Paige says that abuse continued because of cracks in the system. So we asked DCS and the Indiana State Personnel Department questions about children in the foster care system, open cases, and the number of caseworkers. Here's what they found. Paige was adopted by a new family, the Hodges, on October 12, 2018. She says being adopted was life-changing, but getting there was a long journey. They, CPS, didn't even remove me when they found out I was pregnant by someone over the age, Paige said. She says it took her parents, Kenny and Mary, to fail a drug test for DCS to remove her and her two sisters from the home. The girls lived in three foster homes together before being separated. Paige was also separated from her son, Oakley. The child fathered by the family friend, Kenny and Mary Lane, let live in their house with Paige when she was a child. "Really, nobody wanted all three of us. All four of us. Me, my sisters, and Oakley," Paige said, she was told. But the four of them are just one example of the thousands of cases DCS is managing all at the same time. So as of July 2021, DCS, or their Child Protective Services, says that it had 18,123 open cases, and that of those, 11,377 children were in foster care. In Stark County, where Paige's case was handled, DCS currently has 83 open cases. In Marshall County, where Mercedes died, DCS currently has 60 children in the system. According to the Indiana State Personnel Department, there are 2,292 family case managers at DCS, with 160 in training. The number of case managers varies by county. In Stark County, DCS says that there are 15, and in Marshall County, there are 13. Below is a direct passage from DCS on how many children or families one case manager can monitor. So according to this research this person did, it says under Section 5, the department shall ensure that the department maintains staffing levels of family case managers so that each region has enough family case managers. So the case managers are only allowed to have no more than 12 active cases relating to initial assessments, including investigations of an allegation of child abuse or neglect, or 12 families monitored and supervised in active cases relating to ongoing in-home services, or 13 children monitored and supervised in active cases relating to ongoing services who are in out-of-home placements. So based on all of the numbers that DCS gave them, there's an average of 8 kids or families under monitoring per caseworker. But despite coming in under DCS standards, Paige still says the system failed her and her family. And that failure extends to her half-sister, Mercedes Lane. It definitely failed Mercedes, and it failed her family, and it failed her siblings. Back in July, DCS sent Kenny and Tiffany Coburn notices that the agency would be conducting an investigation due to a report of neglect or abuse. It had 40 days from July 21st, the day the notices were issued, to complete the assessment. But 28 days later, Mercedes was dead. Mercedes' aunt, Stacy Milton, and grandmother, Angie Owens, agree DCS failed their family. I agree with that. They were called several times, Milton said. They should have taken her out of that situation a long time ago. And here's another thing. If you have family, your own family, reporting you, and saying this situation is unsafe, they're also trying to actively say, like, I've been in the home and I've seen what's going on and it's not okay. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out why CPS fails so consistently when they have plenty of heads up and warnings. I think in this case, this is more on CPS for failing. But, you know, when you have people trying to do the right thing and nothing happens, you know, it just really highlights the failure of these systems that are supposed to be protecting these children. It's unfortunate that these systems that are supposed to protect children are more intent upon keeping the family unit together, regardless of the safety of the child. And this is where we have to rethink the whole family unit is sacred thing. When the family unit is not only beating or abusing or neglecting, they're raising a child that's going to go out into the world and basically take what they've learned and then put that upon the world. So you're just creating this constant cycle of abuse and patterns. And we aren't going to shake those if we don't have like a real actual shake up of the system. So to me, this is definitely devolved into a CPS is failing mantra, but let's not lose sight of the fact that, you know, the parents are still responsible. Kenny and Tiffany and Justin Miller here are responsible, but, you know, let's also say right here and now that CPS, they've failed repeatedly. Milton and Owens, you know, they'd called about the abuse. They'd tried to report it. The grandma says, I heard there were drugs used there and she was never clean. Milton chimed in about the state of the room, which ABC 57 Investigates saw with their own eyes during our investigation. Now, She says, I knew the way they were. I knew they weren't parent material. Owens says she and others told Tiffany while she was pregnant with Mercedes that family in Indianapolis was willing to take her, adopt her, and give her a loving home, and Tiffany wouldn't hear it. Owens even says that other people at the Economy Inn in Plymouth, where Kenny and Tiffany were staying, called DCS on them too. It's just aggravating that they got so many calls and they failed every time, Milton says. They had several chances to take her out of that environment and they chose not to. So, you know, we're about to get some questions answered, at least some questions that I have. And I know this is going to vary from state to state. So below, we're going to discuss a direct quote from DCS regarding when family case managers can take a child out of the home. Number one is, a reasonable person would believe the child's physical or mental condition is seriously impaired or seriously endangered due to injury by the act or omission of the child's parent, guardian, or custodian. Or, number two, the child's physical or mental condition is seriously impaired or seriously endangered as a result of the inability, refusal, or neglect of the child's parents, guardian, or custodian to supply the child with necessary food, clothing, shelter, medical care, education, or supervision. And three, the coercive intervention of the court is needed to protect the child. These seem like really stupid reasons. Like, okay, so you can't remove a child if you see drug use or there is actual neglect or the home isn't fit for the kid to be living in. None of those things matter. Paige goes on to say that the system is kind of set up to fail them. It's failed a lot of other kids as well, she says. And I feel terrible here, but Hodge, Milton, and Owens, the aunt and the grandmother, etc., and Paige, say they hope their tragedies inspire change to keep kids safe in the future. Listen, this happens every day. Like we said at the beginning, 4 to 7 times every day. No one's learning any lessons here. No one's changing things for good. So I wouldn't be too optimistic there. I also applaud them for this ABC 57 for trying to dig deep into this. That's awesome. But let's just kind of start to wind this down. But both Lane and Coburn will be back in court on January 20th of this new year, 2022. And I hope we learn more about the chain of events that led up to the tragic death and dumping of beautiful little Mercedes' little body in the woods. But let's briefly touch on the drug abuse related to this whole situation. Let's not forget the role that this plays. So Miller, Lane, and Coburn all admitted to using drugs, which included meth and synthetic marijuana. Most of you are probably aware of the fact that drug and alcohol abuse are linked to child abuse, depression, and violence when parents use or abuse substances while pregnant or while trying to raise their child. But let's dig a little deeper here. Now, I wrote that before I had read that, you know, they had reported Tiffany Coburn, you know, while she was pregnant and were trying to actively get this baby Mercedes adopted out before, you know, before she was even born. So with that in mind, you know, it seems to strongly suggest, I'm not saying 100%, but it seems to strongly suggest that Tiffany was using drugs while pregnant. So I looked up some information here just to kind of fully clue us in here, but a study conducted in 2011 called Methamphetamine Using Parents, the relationship between parental role strain and depressive symptoms, reports that, as documented in studies of heterosexual users, many of whom are parents, the highly addictive, sexually stimulating binge and crash nature of methamphetamine may result in children being exposed to a set of parental behaviors that include parents staying high and awake for days, having multiple sex partners, ching ching, we saw that, you know, Mary's partner was living in the house with her and her husband, great, exhibiting erratic and bizarre behaviors, and experiencing extreme euphoria followed by painful withdrawal symptoms, for example, depression, paranoia, irritability, aggression, delusions, or hallucinations. The children of methamphetamine users also may experience a chaotic home life with inadequate supervision, duh, inconsistent parenting, check, chronic neglect, check, parental aggression, violence, and other safety risks, like exposure to chemical and toxic fumes from home-based methamphetamine laboratories to weapons or to criminal activity. In regard to meth use specifically, the National Center on Substance Abuse and Child Welfare reveals that parents who use, manufacture, and or traffic methamphetamine in the presence of children put their children at a higher risk of child abuse and neglect. More generally, of children in out-of-home care, 61% of infants and 41% of older children had a report of active alcohol and or drug abuse by the primary caregiver, the secondary caregiver, or both. In some parts of the country, methamphetamine is the primary substance of abuse. I cannot say definitively, you know, whether or not it has been found out that Tiffany did use meth while pregnant with Mercedes, but it seems like, according to grandma and auntie, that she most likely was. I'm going to just say that it's highly likely. The National Center on Substance Abuse and Child Welfare reveals that methamphetamine use during pregnancy can affect the infant and child's development. A 2019 study that analyzed hospital discharge data from 2004 to 2015 found that by 2014/2015, amphetamine use was identified among approximately 1% of births in rural areas of the western United States. This incidence was higher than the opioid use incidence in most regions. The amphetamine-related deliveries were associated with higher incidence of preeclampsia, preterm delivery, and severe maternal morbidity and mortality. One final thought I would like to end on has to do with Child Protective Services. Again, circling back around. I believe, personally, so I'm going to go out on a limb here, don't shoot me, but I believe that any time they are contacted about a child and that child goes on to die or be murdered, I feel like they should be held responsible in some capacity by the courts. Maybe they need an added incentive to make sure that they do indeed follow up with these cases fully and with the intent to actually protect the child, not simply keep the family unit together no matter what transpired. We need serious reform, which I already said, of our child protective services, our foster care system, and we need to start putting children first. Finally, we just need to do that. I don't know why that's so difficult for us as a society to do, especially in the 21st century, and we still can't get it together for our children. This is not how these systems or bureaucracies are functioning right now. They're not putting children first. And I believe that their lack of effectiveness is now fully functioning criminal negligence. Children are our future, you guys. Let's start prioritizing the future and making the world a safer and better place for them, starting in the home. I'm serious. We don't like hearing about these things because they're unpleasant and it makes us uncomfortable and it's really sad and tragic. But let's do something to change this. Let's make sure that we demand better. Think about how you can be active in your own community to change these things. Thank you for joining me for today's episode. I know it continues to be a bummer and I know that it's tough, but I think these are important stories to share and tell. Talk about this amongst you and your friends. You know, this is something that we all need to get on board with. I urge you all to donate or join local causes in your communities that are working to fight for better children's rights. If you don't know where to start, please visit our website for resources and click on the donate page where I've provided links to some of my favorite child advocacy programs. It's all of our responsibilities to stand up for the rights and lives of children everywhere. This is a fight that's got nothing to do with partisan politics, simply the rights for all children to be safe, loved, and cared for. Thank you guys, and please join the family.